Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. They say that Kempin ain't easy, and it is illustrated by podcasting 9 time zones away from home. Other men would pull an Osello and say, fellas, you're going to have to run a 2-man show today. Not Larkin. Coach Kemp, how you doing, buddy?
Couldn't be doing better. Huge Brown win in a gritty contest against UMass. And I've spent the last few days in Paris, France, and now I'm exploring the Basque region up in northern Spain. So things couldn't be better. Alcohol is flowing, and the Bears are 1-0 on the week.
Kempin seems pretty easy. Can I try Kempin for, like, I don't know, a couple months this year? I'd love to give it a shot.
As long as you have to answer the emails from mom and dad. Yeah, that works. Give it a roll.
Done. And by the way, 2 things that need to happen before I die. 1, I need to get a little sample platter of Notre Dame winning the national championship in football. And 2, I need to play your dad in chess. Those are like top 2 things that I want to see and do before I die.
Love that.
My rating's been dropping recently. And Terry, I didn't appreciate your dig, but continue.
We have an incredible slate of games to talk about, but because of the aforementioned scheduling adjustment, we are not yet aware of the Penn State, Ohio State, Big Ten spotlight game. So we are going to indulge a little creative exercise. Larkin, if Penn State wins and that's the result that we're talking about on Monday morning, how do you think that game unfolded?
So I think Ohio State, especially over the last month of trailing results, has like earned the right to say they are going to try and dictate tempo. Like they have a specific style and a specific form of like rock fight that they want to get Penn State involved in, and ultimately like win the specialties battle and trust Van Buren and their other talented Poles to kind of like out-athlete. So I think if Penn State wins, it's because track meet is the wrong term, but I think they're going to try and speed the game up, rely on their downhill athleticism at the midfield position, and I think they ultimately win this game like 15-12, forcing Ohio State to play a little more open than what they kind of intend. But ultimately, these are 2 good teams on an RPI level, right? It's neither one is like overly impacted by the result. And I think the edge, no different than like a football game, is probably more based on it being a home game for Penn State and ultimately what goes into that. But really excited for the contest. And I guess something to look for early would be like the amount of goals in the first quarter. Can Penn State make it a 3-1-4-2 type effort and start racking up possessions?
Nick, if your friends in Columbus pull it out, what will the game script read like?
It's devious work to make me vouch as an Ohio State fan, and kind of sickening. So you're starting off with 2 punches. But with that being said, credit where credit's due. And to Larkin's point, I think they've earned the right to go in executing their game plan. And the game plan that I've seen, and kind of a theme throughout this week, is the individual matchups that have the largest impact on the games are pulling more weight than I would argue they did last year. So I think Ohio State has the chance to have the top 3 matchups, offensively and defensively. I think the top 3 players of Ohio State outmatch the top 3 players of Penn State. And then that in turn kind of has that trickle down, which doesn't work economics, to the rest of the team to end up, you know what, after this week, I'm going to say they just win 11-10. That seemed to be the theme, 11-10 or 12-11. I think it's going to be a good slugfest, but I think it comes down to 1 or 2 plays, probably a strip and push and transition in the third quarter, or, you know, a gritty face-off win that seals the deal and doesn't allow Penn State to get any momentum if they go down 2 or 3 with 3 minutes left.
Well, that was fun. I think to your point about individual matchups, certainly one of the things to watch will be Penn State's health, particularly at the attack, as they've been playing without Matt Traynor, Kyle Lehman, and I believe Jack Amon recently. So we'll see if any of those guys make their return to host the Buckeyes. We are in the midst of NCAA hysteria, and you're probably expecting me to talk about March Madness, and certainly it's actually, I would say it's kind of been a little bit of a letdown. The spotlight that I want to put on is Matt Madness. Like, I know that
Wyatt Henderson
is unbelievable. Yes. The talking about how awesome college wrestling is not like a hot take. But just It deserves, McAfee talked about this, I think either last week or 2 weeks ago. It deserves its own spotlight. Like, it should be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday after the first round of the basketball tournament. I hate when people come in and, like, try to reinvent somebody else's sport. Like, I'm sure that there are elements of this that are awesome that we don't understand. But, like, if wrestling were Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of this coming week, its ratings would be through the roof.
I have three friends that are wrestling fans. Matt Albano in New Jersey, he didn't play lacrosse, and then the other two are Max Adler and TD Erland. When I tell you, like, the amount of all caps texts that were being sent, it is not hyperbole to say that it's one of, if not the greatest upsets in collegiate sports history. Like, go all the way back in the record books, Wyatt Hendrickson taking down Gable Stevenson, the Olympic gold medalist, who's also like 37 and was on an NFL roster and playing for, I think, the Bills a little bit, kind of wild eligibility. His double leg takedown with what, single leg into double leg, 3 points to go up 6-5. I'm probably butchering a little bit of this. The crowd was so loud that the announcers were screaming and you couldn't even hear the announcers. Like, oh my goodness. I was getting chills. I watched it 100 times last night. It was incredible.
It's the type of clip, and there have been some of the others. I remember Ferreira, the Oklahoma State, or Ferrari, whatever his name was, where you can actually start to see the DNA lineage between, like, amateur, like, real wrestling, freestyle wrestling, and pro wrestling. And Larkin, you know more about that than either Nick or I do. But to the point that you just made, and to the reason that this is the intro into talking about men's and women's NCAA championship weekend, once again, congratulations to the NCAA on another fantastic championship outing.
We will get into lacrosse, but I put that up there with some of the greatest sports clips of all time. Jason Lezak coming back in the 08 Olympics, the 4x100 meter.
Yep.
That one gives me chills. It was Jesse Diggins, cross country skiing at, I believe, the Pyeongchang Olympics, where the announcers are going nuts to get the U.S.'s first gold medal. Like, there are just some certain sports clips that, regardless of if you know anything about it, elevate above all the rest. And to watch one in real time was literal chills.
You know, one that I watch like once a quarter because it's like 3 minutes and 45 seconds long, which is the perfect time to watch something on YouTube, is Matt Centrowitz's gold medal in the mile in Rio. That one was just, cause it's like, he wasn't the fastest guy. He just ran the best race. And there's something so pure about that.
Oh, God, I could go Balotelli to Aguero. I'm not even a big football fan, but just the announcer, the crowd pop, anything. And by the way, all of this discussion is under the umbrella that what a lacrosse weekend it was. 14 one-goal games with 6 going into at least one overtime. Ranked upsets happening all over the place. Like, this is March. If you didn't watch a single game, just assume that your team won or lost by one goal in a hell of a matchup. I mean, over under just 22.5 across the board. Congrats, Vegas. But to start and to be respectful
to start, this year, SI Lacrosse is proud to partner with the NCAA to offer you, our loyal listeners, $5 off all single-day ticket options, men's and women, using code ILPOD at checkout. So head to NCAA.com/LaxTickets and enter ILPOD at checkout to purchase your tickets. You know you're going to be there championship weekend. Why not get $5 off and help us show the NCAA how awesome our loyal listeners are by purchasing your tickets today? Once again, NCAA.com/LaxTickets, ILPOD at checkout for $5 off.
ILPOD. Check out, $5 off. To start, we're going to talk about Brown taking down UMass. Now, you might not think that that's the marquee headline of the game, but even before the game started, Larkin, tell me about the atmosphere, because you were able to watch this in Basque, right?
I was in Paris at the time.
Paris.
In a nice cafe. Yeah, I was, you know, luckily I was with the tech guy who could figure out how to work the VPN math to kind of give me an opportunity to do ESPN Plus. But ultimately, I think this was an important matchup as a measuring stick for John Torpy and his ability to market to recruits. Like, we at Brown take a lot of pride, obviously, in our product, but this is a bar fight every year. Like, this game, in years in which UMass is really good and or Brown is very good, either way, it's kind of like a 10-9, you know, last person with the ball. So just really proud of the guys, really proud of the effort. Ada McLean dinged up and out. You know, we're super banged up, like, Connor Foley,
Mateo Corsi also out.
Mateo Corsi banged up. Jackson Wolfram, you know, arguably our best freshman last year, out for the season. These are core offensive pieces. And if anyone watches us, like, without Aiden, you know, we really struggle to draw slides. So this is you know, heading into to Garber, hard place to win. You guys all know how I feel about Greg Kinnella. Like, this was a true kind of feather in the cap for Torpy and the staff. And I know that just on a human level, I'm, like, really proud of the fight. Like, as you guys know and hear me talk about all the time, like, I really deeply care about that stuff. And we all do at Brown. And, you know, Yale hasn't been this bad in a decade, right? Like, you know, we can talk about Dartmouth's progress, but that's still a gettable game. Like, this is a real top 20, top 25 RPI win that allows us to build into the Ivy League slate. And conversely, and I think this is a broader theme, which we're going to talk about because BU clipped Army and some of the other results, we are setting up for a very highly compelling tournament, basically like league tournaments with respect to the A-10, the Big East, right? Denver beats Duke. There's going to be some massive games down the stretch in April. And, you know, ultimately the product was what it was, but just proud of the guys. So I'll stop there.
I want to build on Larkin's praise and compliments towards the staff, because I think when you combine the injuries with the kind of unexpected familiarity, given the fact that these guys had played UMass each of the last 2 years as part of the A-10 when they were at High Point, in conjunction with going on the road and coming off of a disappointing result against Villanova, shortish week by virtue of that, you know, it was there was a lot of variables that could have stacked up against this one, you know, from a Brown standpoint, that would have made a loss pretty explainable, I think. And obviously to not accept that speaks to the grit that Larkin talked about. I think that Jeremy Hopsicker, Notre Dame transfer, ice in his veins, you know, we wouldn't be doing a disservice not to mention his name. And obviously Connor Nolan, the goalie, who has been playing at an All-American level so far this season, just another incredible outing. And then as a little bit of a quirk, I just want to shout out, this was an incredible week for commentary. The commentators, I thought, on these broadcasts or these web streams were exceptional. The camera work, not as much. We have a quality of play standard, a commentary standard, and then a camera work standard. And it would be great if folks operating the camera understood the value of having the goal in frame all the time when the ball is in one end of the field. So, Shout out to the UMass commentating team, who I thought were awesome, particularly the play-by-play guy's ability to translate from minutes, seconds remaining into just seconds remaining. When he dropped, there's 307 seconds left in this game. I was like, wow, that is some on-the-fly math. Good for you.
New England State School commentators always have some pop. You just, like, grab a drunk Irish guy out of a bar and, like, throw him on the mic, and away we go. One last piece. I really don't like how lacrosse – it's so hard to judge goaltending because of the inability to separate between what is like a high quality look versus just an okay look. And because of that, like, both media and coaches have to rely a ton on statistics that can index for a variety of reasons, right? And ultimately, like, typically good goalies on good to great teams get a lot of accolades. So I just want to double down on, like, Connor Foley's been elite. Like, we're playing okay to good defense and he's like 60%+ every outing. And for all goalies out there on, like, struggling groups, like, I see you and I respect you immensely. And I hope guys like that get their flowers, but we can move on because there's a lot of huge games.
So, and you guys talk at such a high level. I'm going to bring it back down to the casual viewer, casual fan. The two metrics that I always look at, and they're not even metrics. That's just a fancy word that I use that you guys know that I don't. I really like looking at how teams, if you're looking to really understand the core of a team, how do they respond to losses and how do they respond to injuries and when guys go down? So I will say that, like, Larkin, we've been hearing you say for a long time that, you know, oh, Brown's gritty, tough, core, this and that. And I think this is the best example that we've seen. And kind of parlaying off of that idea, how do you bounce back from a loss? Well, Michigan got their, you know, doors blown off by Notre Dame last week. What do? They come back in the greatest fashion possible by getting their first win over a number one ranked program. Terry, you said it best. You have to respect history. I mean, so Michigan wins 11-10 in triple OT. And the reason why you respect history, this is their fourth straight time beating Maryland. So And in addition, you know, Michigan advanced to the Sweet 16 yesterday. So credit to the Blue. Great day to be wearing an M on your chest. There were 8 lead changes and no team led by more than 2. I feel like Michigan had a very strong and balanced attack from the get-go. Ryan Cohen, Jack Jenkins, Nick Rude, and Lucas Stinnett each having 2 apiece. On Maryland, Daniel Kelly with a hat trick, and down 2 in the fourth quarter, Bryce Ford was the only player to score in the fourth quarter, netting 2 to send it to OT. It also a great goalie battle. McNaney is just an, like, if you're a goalie, just watch every Maryland game. It's legitimately fun. It reminds me of Entman last year, and I'd have to kind of go back to think of how much fun I have watching a goaltender, which is kind of counterintuitive because I love when goals go in. But McNaney is just operating on a different level. But his counterpart, Hunter Taylor, was a treat. So if you're a goalie, go back and rewatch this game and just watch the big, impactful saves that were happening from opening faceoff to both OTs. Terry, I'm almost done here. After 2 scoreless OT periods, Emmett Houlihan played an unbelievable game for Michigan, and he drew the double team, and it was that classic dodge down the alley, pass up top, pass to the backside, a la Westberg in 2015. Not going to be too upset about it. Nick Rude was the goal scorer, but got to give Emmett Houlihan his just desserts with, just, again, we use that term gravity. He was the gravitational pull that ultimately led Michigan to their triple OT winner. Michigan just doing Michigan things. Terry.
So with respect to the history point, it's not just about the fact that they've now beaten them 4 times in a row. It's also about the fact that, and we talked about this last week, the context of these 3 regular season wins in a row are pretty much identical. And the way in which it's been the baseline for, or the platform for, the late run of their season. Now, I should remind you, a couple years ago, they still lost after this game, right? It did, this beating Maryland wasn't the rocket fuel that propelled them the rest of the way. So, you know, it's not necessarily even going to be smooth sailing such that they can still, you know, get to the Big Ten tournament. Well, everybody makes it to the Big Ten tournament, but then, you know, win a game or win the Big Ten and then ultimately make it to the NCAA tournament. To the point about Hunter Taylor, you know, I think if you look at him statistically, and obviously Larkin just mentioned this, it can be very misleading. You know, he's played incredible in their 2 enormous wins over Canisius and Marquette, where they allowed a total of 3 goals combined between the 2 of them. And then, you know, I think he was at 37% against Notre Dame. And so they're, you know, coming away from the Notre Dame game. And I think that's ultimately like where the propensity to not overreact, but react very strongly, because that is the standard that this sport has set over the last 2 years. You might say, all right, well, they have a little bit of a problem in goal. And then the other thing that I heard was they're asking too much out of Pace Billings. And particularly, that's the part about the historical context that I think is really important, is that, you know, and this is true for BU versus Army as well, that streak was largely done by the same group of personnel, and that group graduated after last year, and similarly for Michigan. You know, obviously Ryan Cohen has been involved in these, but Lucas Stannett has not. Pace Billings has not. And so, you know, there were a new group of guys. Emmett Houlihan didn't have a big role. Nick Rude did not have a big role. So I think the question is, like, how is this happening and why is this happening? And to the point about Hunter Taylor, I think more important than even the game-winning goal was the save that Taylor made at the end of the second overtime, when Jack McDonald, stripped of Michigan ball carrier at the top of the box, came down in transition, hands-free, high bouncer. Taylor goes down on it, but does the thing that's so hard and so impressive when goalies can do, which is reverses his stick in order. This ball was absolutely sneaking in underneath the crossbar, and Taylor was able to completely invert his stick in order to make that save and collect the high bouncer. Otherwise, game over, Maryland survives, and we're talking about a much different result. To the point about the change in personnel, the plan is still very much the same. Michigan appears to be more comfortable and confident in the fact that Maryland cannot get an advantage from the attack, dodging from the attack, relative to the rest of the college lacrosse landscape. And as a result, they double pulled the first midfield. They double pulled the second midfield, and ultimately it didn't end up costing them. And it was crazy because, Larkin, I love when you use the term pillow fight. Overtime was kind of a pillow fight offensively. Michigan came out of a timeout with 26 seconds left on the shot clock in the first overtime and had to throw the ball into the corner. Like, what more do you need in terms of evidence that, like, it was impossible to win matchups? And that's why, you know, it's tough. Like, for me, I did my draft of the midseason All-America list last week, and I had Eric Kolar as a first-team short-stick D midfielder. The nature of being a short-stick D midfielder is that you're probably going to show up on a lot of highlights of big goals, and that's what happened. What is, so I know what a crowbar is, and I know what a jam is. What is the term when a, it's more than a lift. He got his entire shoulder and like arm into Houlihan and tried to lift, but in so doing lost his footing. And that's what sparked the early slide, which is what got Root open in the inside for that game winning goal. Whatever it was, just an unfortunate play. Happens to short-stick middies multiple times a game. Not going to be the determining factor in whether or not you put together an All-American season. But with all that being said, Largan, I'll turn it over to you because I just kind of dumped everything that I have in my brain about this game, you know, out into the ether, and I'm hoping that you can distill some of it.
I mean, it was a massive win, right? I think that what often gets lost in Michigan now being a part of the Big Ten and the marquee matchups that they've played in is their four wins this season prior to beating Maryland at Maryland were Marquette, Hobart, Canisius, and Cleveland State. So when people slide into my DMs and rightfully call me out for my inappropriate take about the outcome of this game, I would just remind people that based on the KPIs we had heading in, this was a big hill to climb, other than the historical precedent that clearly Kevin and his staff have a an understanding of the way in which Tillman wants to do things, and they've gotten belief in the room that they have a plan that can be executed both on the road and at home in Ann Arbor. And listen, beating John Tillman four times in a row, like, that's the type of stuff you write on your epitaph, like at the end of your coaching journey. So it's a massive result. And just to briefly touch on something that I got pounded for this week, the highest compliment I can pay a program is that I think the head coaching job is a top 5 to 10 job in this sport. Like, Nebraska has a proud football tradition. We are not a top 10 job anymore, right? Just because you have historical success, precedent, and, you know, a laundry list of All-American defensive linemen and offensive guards in the 1990s doesn't mean that Dan Lanning would leave Oregon to go to Nebraska to coach football, okay? Michigan is an elite desk, and this was an elite result, so he deserves a ton of credit for that. But ultimately, like, over the next 4 weeks, we're going to learn a ton, right? They're Hop, Penn State, Rutgers, Ohio State. Their entire resume currently is just pegged to basically Tillman and the Terps staying at one in the RPI. What happens if the Terps drop a few spots, right? So they need to knock a few of these teams off. And really what you're seeing form in the Big Ten, which is exciting, I think, for fans, is like you're seeing the bubble evolve in real time. Like those games between a Hopkins and a Michigan, right? That's kind of like a bubble matchup, right? It could be a scenario in which, you know, win and you're in. So it's a huge credit to the guys. But the other thing that's really interesting about this is they really played the game at Maryland's tempo. It's very hard to beat Maryland 10-9. Like, you typically, at least in my head, when I think back to like Schellenberger and the Hoos kind of like increasing the pace of play and getting that team moving, you know, you're really in a chess match at that point. And to his credit, and he deserves to dance on my grave this week, he outcoached John Tillman at Maryland.
There is the point to be made that, like, yes, outcoach John Tillman. Should this be where Michigan, you know, this is the standard. This shouldn't be the outlier. So I was thinking about it, Larkin, and I know we were kind of going back and forth in our group chat, but, you know, the more that I read about marquee wins for Michigan or other, you know, big profile schools that may be underachieving, the more I'm like, this shouldn't be like a, oh, huge. And granted, it's kind of weird because they've gone 4-0 and then they've dropped a couple other games. But, you know, if I'm putting my Larkin Michigan hater hat on, I'm going, okay, great, but I'm not going to over-index it. To your point, I'm going to watch how these next 4 weeks play out, because if history repeats itself, hey, we're the team that beats Maryland, but then, you know, doesn't do anything with it. So I think Michigan is a great opportunity to actually parlay this into momentum, as opposed to just having this be a nice, hey, come to Michigan because we can beat Maryland every now and again.
Well, it's Michigan as a job, when you think about the input variable, sits at a very interesting convergence of like a very good school, right? So unlike Penn State and Ohio State, you can actually look at the composition of top 100 recruits 40 to 50 of which like want the kids to get into the best school possible, right? And yeah, maybe you don't need to go to like Harvard, but that is why, you know, UVA or UNC may win a recruiting battle, or like Duke over Penn State if they're offering identical money, right? And Michigan is a really good school. Like the business school has an elite pipeline, you know, of jobs in New York City and like high paying monetization opportunities and all the different buzzwords that you get thrown at, you know, brochure type stuff. But listen, guys, in 25 years, the Syracuse alums and the Hop alums are going to hate to hear this, but what is the actual argument that Syracuse's future doesn't look more like Nebraska football, which is we have the most proud tradition in the sport. Like we've sold out every game for 40 years, right? There is no bigger celebrity in the world than the kid who wears 22 at Cuse in the dome, than the kid who plays quarterback in Nebraska. But you go 9-3 and you can't beat Texas, Oklahoma, Bama for those kids. And so I just look at it as like, I am trying to compliment the desk. Like I could easily go the other direction with it. I just think it's an elite job and they should be going 9-3 every year and clipping teams like this. So credit to them. And you know, they pounded me.
It's well, okay, hold on. So it's such revisionist. It's so revisionist to use this result as a commentary on the argument. The argument, the reason that it was a good argument is because I could have called you a fool on the basis of the fact that Michigan was back-to-back defending Big Ten champs, right? Like, that is the counter-argument. But the point that you would, rightfully, I guess, otherwise argue is, yeah, and they just got smoked by Notre Dame. And so the point is that both things can be true. If you are, like your job is not in jeopardy because you are back-to-back two-time Big Ten champions. But at the same time, like, this program should aspire to heights where they are beating Notre Dame consistently. And that was not what was the evidence last week. So with all for all of the potential conversation that this could be about Michigan, I just want to make sure that this does not go unsaid. For about 7 or 8 weeks now, and certainly 6, 7 weeks ago, I did say that Maryland has so much talent on their roster that the benefit of the talent offensively is going to be the maneuvering that John Tillman and Michael Phipps are going to be able to do. You can't do it if you don't lose, because like you can't disrupt the apple cart substantially if things are going right. But once you lose and once Penn State is coming to town, all bets are off. I do not envy Joe Bucci's responsibility to guess what Maryland is going to look like offensive personnel packages wise when they head to College Park. I think the game's in College Park, when they head to College Park next weekend.
I agree. Bad week to be a Nittany Lion. Hopefully they clip Ohio State in a few hours, but it's and I think it, if you hold the stock of Maryland dogpiling in June, like we'll learn a lot from the offensive production this week and the response to this game.
How do you bounce back from losses? So, moving on, we're going back to the Ivy League. Dartmouth, in another overtime game of the week, takes down Penn. And, you know, real deal alert. You know, hit that button. Put Dartmouth on your map. Circle them on your schedule, because they're no longer a team that you can just cruise by. They've been proving that, you know, week in and week out this year. But this is kind of, you know, a bigger statement win in conference. And before we dive into this game, let's just give Sean Kerwin his just desserts. And Terry, who wrote the article of the game breakdown?
Joe Santaliquido,
great Irish kid. Go and read that article, because there are some fantastic nuggets in there. Dartmouth has been killed at Penn for so long. So a couple stats that I want to share. 7-1 for the first time since 2003. They're close to matching their win total from the last two seasons combined. Right now they're at 7. Last two seasons it's been 9 total. They hadn't won at Penn since 2005. 2005 is a long time ago. That's 20 years ago.
I graduated from high school in 2003, and I haven't paid for a haircut in 12 years. Just to give you a sense for how old and how long ago that was.
Last time they had a win, Terry could drive with his windows down and feel the wind going through whatever hair he had left. So again, huge credit to Kerwin, and it was a great, like, gross, dirty, rainy, cold, ugly March matchup. And essentially it was a goalie and defensive clinic. You know, I don't try to make excuses for the offense when it's rainy and cold. Obviously it's going to impact the offenses, but at the end of the day, everyone's knows how to play in rain. When you get to D1, you got to learn how to, you know, battle the elements and weather the storm. It was just an offensive nightmare. Goals were hard to come by. Zero goals in the third quarter and sloppy droughts by both offenses. Emmett Paradine had three, and there were five other contributors for Dartmouth. Davis Provost with three for Penn and only five other contributors. So I guess you could make an argument that it was Dartmouth's offensive depth and ability to share the ball that was the only reason why they had, you know, marginally more success. But ultimately, it was freshman Alex Jesse who drove up the hash from X and did a jump shot near side, which is cocky on a right-handed goalie. He shot near side, stick side high to seal the deal. You know, the big green dogpiling Larkin. What's this mean for the Ivy?
I think long term it means great things. Like, To clear the air, Sean Kerwin's a dear friend of mine. Like, I obviously played for him at Brown, and we remain in touch, so I'm heavily biased, and, like, I've been a supporter of his and will continue to be kind of irrelevant to, obviously, now he's coaching an in-league rival. But one of the hardest things to do in sports is to take a cellar dweller, like a team that hasn't had belief in the room, in not only, like, multiple years or cycles of captaincy and seniors leadership, but, like, literally people... You know, there hasn't been like a spark in a Dartmouth locker room in terms of a true path to 3-3 in the Ivy League, to Terry's point, in like a decade plus, right? So it's not an easy thing to do. And when you were looking at him as like a coaching candidate, if you wanted to build a bear case, right, like a devil's advocacy argument, it's that he's won everywhere he's been, but he's won with elite talent. Like, he was at Tufts and they draw extremely well in terms of recruiting. Dylan Malloy is the greatest, you know, hidden gem recruit, you know, outperformer in the history of our school, and just an elite person. And obviously at Virginia, it's Virginia, right? So he's put all of that to bed. Like, he has an elite offensive mind. He clearly understands how to, you know, put offensive players with leverage in space and to generate above average looks. And more than anything, I think what he does very well is he makes like okay players believe they're great, and he makes great players believe they're elite. And there's an inverse waterfall effect where the whole roster gets a little bit better. Like, Penn was 2-4 in the last six. Penn has not been trending. Like, you know, they barely survived Brown last week. I thought St. Joe's candidly on film outclassed them. They have two elite cover athletes at defense, which like muddies everything up and makes it very hard to blow out Penn. But I don't think they're a great group this year. So I think it's extreme to say that Dartmouth hosting Princeton this weekend will be two like elite offenses or whatever the term is. But what I would say, and the highest compliment I can pay to the Dartmouth alumni base and all the fundraisers and guys like that, is in 2 years, like, he's taken a nobody and he's made them competitive. They're 1-1 against top 25 RPI teams. They lost to UMass. They beat Penn and OT. That is a massive step forward. So, like, open your checkbook. Support him in recruiting, do all the different things that go into it, and you'll ultimately just lose all those recruiting battles to Brown because we're going to be doing the same thing. But really happy for my friend, and it's a huge win.
I want to add a stat, Nick, that I think is very illustrative, not just of the duration, but also the actual specific stakes. And Larkin, you'll appreciate this one. This was the biggest game. So, like, beating Harvard 2 years ago was the biggest game coming away in 13 years. But going in, this was the biggest game going into it for Dartmouth since the season finale against Brown in 2010. In that scenario, Brown was 3-2, Dartmouth was 2-3 in the Ivy League. If Dartmouth had won, they would have won the head-to-head tiebreaker. They both would have finished 3-3, and Dartmouth would have finished fourth in the Ivy League and gone to the Ivy League tournament. So, 15 years. I mean, that is a remarkable, you know, and the reason is because they were a top 20 team. And candidly, they didn't deserve to be a top 20 team on the basis of resume. They would deserve to be a top 20 team on the basis of their record. And their record was a reflection of their strength schedule, as Larkin just pointed out. Which is the reason that this was such a big game, was because the delta between what a win versus a loss was going to do in terms of validating was so wide. Imagine if they had lost 9-8 in overtime. Nothing about the performance would have been different other than whether or not one shot went into the goal. Yet, what it would have meant for the perception of how back or how for real they are would have been really substantial. And so that is why it was such a big game. What's crazy is I actually think that there are a lot of positives to take away on the Penn side from this. The offensive production has been very attack-oriented for the last several years, basically since Sam Hanley's graduation. And when you look at, and it felt this way in real time, because I thought Davis Provost played exceptionally well. I thought Leo Hoffman played maybe his best game in a Penn uniform. And I thought Griffin Skane showed the two-way ability that makes you see like, okay, yeah, that's the pick whatever enormous two-way midfielder whose brother is in the NFL that you want. And it was the attack production that actually came up short for Penn in this one, with Cam Rubin and not Tynan Walsh, Ben Smith being held to just one goal apiece. Like, those guys are usually going to be good. Like, those two will combine for 4.5-5 goals in a typical Ivy League game. And that, I think, for me, was kind of the basis. And then the other side of the coin was that Mason Morrill outplayed an All-American counterpart at the other end of the field in goal with a +6 save delta versus a -1 save delta. So the thing I would say about Dartmouth that makes it even more impressive is Hopper Zapatala went down in the game, and he was their third leading scorer on the year coming in. And so some of the things that I said about Penn that were really positive in terms of the getting the midfield production going is probably matters more than losing to Dartmouth hurts. I don't know that that's necessarily true, but it's like a 51-49 type split. For Dartmouth, I think getting the midfield production when Thomas Power and Connor McGill had been so important for them, particularly against a defense that, regardless of how well they're playing for 7 years, they've been a top 8 unit in the country, is super important. And so, you know, I felt like watching this one that these were two teams that kind of were right where they belonged ranking wise. You know, it felt similar to Syracuse Colgate. It was a reflection of what the narrative on each team kind of was and had been. And so, I won't disagree with you, Larkin, in terms of the St. Joe's game and what it looked like and what it felt like watching. But at the same time, it doesn't make me think that Penn is in, you know, they probably aren't a top 20 team based on resume, but they're between 21 and 23. And so there's still a ton of value for Dartmouth to come away with that W.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And I think long term, the health of the bubble in the Ivy in terms of Ivy League tournaments every year, forever it's kind of been, you know, kind of, this is an oversimplification, so, you know, certain schools alums are going to be upset by this, but let's call it Cornell and Princeton safely in every year. And then you have this fascinating, like, four-way battle where, you know, the path to 3-3 and, like, who out of Yale, Penn, Harvard, Brown can, like, take those two spots. And then that tournament is always fascinating because the 3-4 seed, like, often win it. It's not a tournament that the one seed wins every time. So it's just, it's, like, super healthy for the league to have the 7th team now be not only trending, but, like, potentially not an RPI drag and, like, a threat and all those different things. So it's great.
And I really like Dartmouth in the next, I don't know, 2 to 3 years. Like, I feel like, Larkin, you may have made the point earlier this year that the toughest part of taking over a program, is it going from bad to good or is it going from good to great? And I feel like that bad to good and separating yourselves from, you know, the bottom of the barrel only creates this flywheel that is inevitably, when you have the resources, the stature of an Ivy League school, and there's no longer the narrative of like, all right, I guess I'll go play for Dartmouth because I want to go to an Ivy League school, even though we're going to get, you know, our balls kicked in every single game. Like, one season, and it's this season for Dartmouth, my goodness, can that change the next 10 years and truly enter the recruiting battles with, you said, the other bubble teams in the Ivy. So, again, I know Kerwin's your boy. I know we've kind of been, you know, really excited about him. I was going to say something that we probably have to edit out, but I don't think enough can be said about, you know, going from bottom of the barrel to, oh, they're a contender. for the Ivy League tournament. That's just fantastic. So moving on, Terry, you said it best, respect history. Boston beats number three Army, hands the Army its first loss this year, 10-9 in overtime. It was yet another game in which the majority of time was spent with it being tied or a one-goal game. In fact, the only two-goal lead was when Army was up 3-1. And credit to good friend Jack Rowlett. I love when he tweets the videos of the Boston locker room going absolutely nuts after games. Makes me, you know, miss being a part of the locker room. Jimmy Corr scored in OT off of that great dodge pass. But it was Andrew Papp, the freshman wearing 99. He's a freshman wearing number 99 and had four goals on the day, you know, playing hero ball. And another theme that kind of has been tracking throughout this week and through the weekend was another great goalie matchup. Sean Byrne of Army, I would say he's the second best goalie in the country, or likely the second best goalie in the country. The statistics back it up. He had 18 saves on the day, and Will Barnes for Boston stepped up huge throughout the game, making 22 saves, and just Boston doing Boston things. Terry, history repeats itself again.
I'm going to drop a little bit of a history lesson on you. Did you know that Woody Guthrie wrote the lyrics to I'm Shipping Up to Boston?
No.
And do you realize, so the story is that the lead singer of the Dropkick Murphys got access to all these unpublished lyrics that from the Guthrie estate. And he was like, yeah, it was an absolute like pleasure or opportunity to get an opportunity to get the chance to look at this. Like Elvis Costello had tried and hadn't been given permission or whatever. And that's great. It's a good story. And then you look at the lyrics of Shipping Up to Boston, and literally the entire song is, I'm a sailor peg and I lost my leg. Climbing up the stopsail, I lost my leg. That's it. Those are the only words in the song. Anyway.
No, there's also, I'm shipping up to Boston. Whoa.
Correct. You're right. I'm sorry. This one was incredible. Again, like, I just want to reiterate the fact that this, it wasn't even just that this was a new group, right? Like, you know, that core offensive, that of offensive, D'Alto and company was 4-year run for Boston University that took the program from one level and established a new height for it. And those guys are all gone. And not only that, but also Mike Rooney, who has been, you know, one of their most important players, kind of triggering the offense, on that first midfield, a freshman, was injured. And so they take a third line middy, a freshman, put him in there, and he goes for four. And I feel like that is kind of the nature of 2025 and the thing that has made this season so exciting, and also just a return to what college athletics are and are supposed to be. And we should be reminded of the fact that the last four and a half years were an aberration. And so with that being said, again, like, there is this bizarre connectivity, and it's not just about the psychological belief, although I do think that is very important. I think it also is about, like, the fundamental understanding of the way in which the tactics manifest. And I think that's one of the reasons that Army playing Colgate is really interesting. Judd Lattimore institutes the 10-man ride at Boston University, leaves BU, goes to Colgate, institutes a similar 10-man ride, and last year Army struggles with Colgate as well. So there's pretty clearly to me something about not just clearing against the 10-man, because I think ultimately, like, the game is more complicated than that. It cannot be simplified down to what that is, but effectively the aura of a team that is good at 10-manning and the way in which it impacts the entirety of the game that manifests in something that just doesn't gel very well with Army, but then very clearly gels incredibly well with Navy, and that's why BU can't beat Navy, which we talked about despite the face-off advantage that they had a couple weeks ago. And so, again, I just want to shout out the commentary for this one. It was incredible. Make sure you check the highlights with the commentary from this game. But yeah, ultimately, you know, talking to Ryan Pulley when they were on the bus on the way home, you know, he shouted out Will Barnes first, and of course you would. To me, there wasn't a singular moment that was a singular save that was as significant as the Hunter Taylor high bouncer save, not because he didn't make saves in overtime, but because they were definitely more like in the flow of what the defense wanted to give up, I felt like. Whereas like the Andrew Pape was, I mean, his dodge rollback hockey assist that set up the Jimmy Corr step down was I mean, that was Ryan called it. He's like, it was the play of the game. And I think the reason that he was so proud of it is because it was what they'd been working on. And you always hear that being an offensive midfielder in college lacrosse is the hardest transition from high school to college, and why you tend to see a lot of those guys kind of sit as freshmen and start to emerge as sophomores. And so for a guy who didn't have meaningful game experience to come in what was the Terriers' biggest game of the season to date and perform like that, speaks to just, I mean, he said he's like, he grew up today. And I feel like the answer is, and I want to shout out Chad Palumbo. We'll get to Harvard Princeton in a second, but his comment post game in that win was really telling, and I really appreciated it. He said that we lost the Cornell game Monday through Friday of that week, basically that their 6-day preparation was not on point. And that's what I want to say about what Andrew Pape obviously was. Like, he didn't grow up in the game on Saturday. He grew up in the weeks of practice that put him in a position where he was going to roll back and throw that very tight pass to Tyler Fox, who could then move it on to Jimmy Corr for that game-winning goal. And that's where the credit goes, is to the attentiveness and the showing up and the discipline every day in practice in order to be able to do the thing that you were supposed to do, that you were training to do when you were called upon in the most pivotal moments of the game. And so, big win for BU. They're now 3-1 in the Patriot League, as are the Black Knights. And, you know, I think you could tell, like, the broadcast was a little disappointed that it took the shine off the apple with North Carolina coming to town, and that, you know, potential to be like a 1-2 matchup. It's not going to be that, but at the same time, it's going to be really meaningful, because now, you know, if you're Army, it was funny, like, on the broadcast of the Rutgers-Hopkins game, they're already talking about the prospect of Army needing to get in through the Patriot League qualifier. I'm not there yet, but certainly a win over Carolina would be pivotal toward keeping their at-large bid hopes alive.
Yeah, I thought that was really great context. I guess just a little bit of additional detail that I think is compelling. When, about a week into the season, when Army had three tapes, right, they looked fantastic against UMass, Rutgers, and Yale. Like, the machine was rolling. I think what basically and I think Army's quite good. I think what basically happened is they got somewhat lulled to sleep because their schedule, you know, not necessarily their fault, but more or less just hit this like massive cliff in terms of kind of like cupcake. And ultimately what you're left with is like non-meaningful fourth quarter film and, you know, perhaps some bad habits as you empty the bench. And So I think I want to double down on, like, I do believe that Army is a good team, but this puts them in a really challenging position, and obviously there's going to be some really high leverage ball down the stretch of having to, you know, realistically win the Patriot League to get in, you know, pending what happens next weekend with the Heels. But I will say that BU is a very sneaky 7-1. And, you know, we just spent 15 minutes talking about Dartmouth. Like, you know, they've played two good games, right? BU, they've beaten Brown, they beat Bucknell, Loyola, and Army, and their only loss is to Navy. I mean, they're putting together a nice little string here, and they have a variable that they've decided to make their core identity, which is this 10-man, and the willingness to give up 2-3 goals a game, let's call it, in what equates to, like, bad defensive lacrosse, because you're creating space and leverage for midfielders coming downhill. So it's just fascinating to track. Like, BU has kind of, you know, they've been able to string past the Roy Meyer era, let's call it, of, hey, a lot of talent left the building last year, and they're still 7-1, right? Loyola's 0-8. So I want to give Poli his flowers and credit to those guys, and Rowlett, to your point, Osello, he's doing a great job. And it's a huge win. And we're going to learn a lot about BU at Harvard in 3 days here. 2 days, sorry.
So moving on, this to me was the most surprising result of the weekend, certainly from a domination standpoint. Everybody was sneaking by each other, but Denver comes out and just beats the tar out of Duke. Final score of 13-6. They, you know, Denver not just showed some life, but I feel like took out some frustrations with their best win of the season. They break 500 and improve to 5-4. I hate to say this. The zone was incredibly effective against Duke, and DU held Duke scoreless for 42 minutes. And if that's not a red flag for Duke's offense, I truly do not know what is. Noah Manning tied Duke himself as he put six in the back of the net. And a lovely sampler platter from a variety standpoint, just on the variety of goals that he was scoring. You know, six kind of unique goals, inside, outside, dodging. He's a fun player to watch. Added two assists for a nice little eight-point day. From the start of the second quarter until 3 minutes left, DU outscored Duke 9-0. And do you even call it a run if it's spread out over that length of time? Like, oh, DU went on a 9-0 run? No, they just dominated. And by the time Duke scored its final three, it was already 13-3. DU to play Nova next week and Duke coming to Notre Dame, or Duke playing Notre Dame, it might be in Durham, and Notre Dame's coming off a bye, so we can talk about this game and the trajectory of both teams moving forward. Larkin, we could start with you.
I agree completely. It was the most surprising result of the weekend. I did believe Duke was on upset alert. I think the way it happened is what's shocking. Rightfully so, I think people have been very bearish on the Duke product and the inconsistency with respect to offensive efficiency. But like, just to give them like a little bit of foundational credibility, they've beaten Michigan, Penn, Richmond, St. Joe's, okay? They lost 15-14 to Princeton, who I think is universally acknowledged as like a good lacrosse team, right? And, you know, we know Michigan just beat Maryland. So this isn't like the worst Duke team in 20 years. This is just a hard Duke team to wrangle. And I think that, you know, I think realistically it's because they're like, lack of core offensive identity where there's nowhere you can kind of like sharpie in of this is how they're going to attack you and this is where it's coming from. They kind of have like an athletic set of pieces that they're trying to jam into holes, it feels like. So I think, you know, he's obviously a legend of the game, but Matt Danowski, like, it is, people are kind of questioning his utilization of this core group of humans. That's not to say he can't figure it out this weekend, but the other piece that I think is interesting is Denver, I think, has had, ever since Bill went there, kind of like they have established enough respect where even in years in which maybe they don't have like the Final Four quality, they don't get on a plane to Ithaca and lose 15-5 to Cornell, right? They don't go to New Haven in a year where Andy Shays has the worst defense he's had in 20 years and get their head kicked in the first quarter. Like, this is a Denver team that their actual quality has been indexing below the respect like I as a lacrosse fan have for Matt Brown and that coaching staff and their consistency of product.
Their RPI was 44 heading into this game, and that felt right.
Right, exactly. No one would want to bet against them at 44 in the sense that no coach wants to see them on the schedule as an RPI drag. But just the way it happened, and to your point, Nick, like Duke should have enough quality with respect to ball handling and push-pull efficiency to be able to break down a zone. There's literally 30 guys on the team. I could hit a 7-iron at the roster and hit a guy who can like hammer it from 18 yards with two hands. Like, it's not a team that should ever be zone busted, right? So it's wild, and it's a circle the wagon moment for Duke, and they're back on the bubble. Like, they are not, in my mind, sharpied in at all.
And to your point, Larkin, like, really what it comes down to me is like the zone is essentially a gimmick to try and disrupt the rhythm of quality offense. And in particular, the talent level of quality offensive players. So you use that to disrupt them really flowing. At least from our perspective, when we were drawing up our zone busting, the zone busting was more like a 3-3 free man up. Like, hey, let's just put six guys out there who know what they're doing, who understand space. Like, yes, we have one player who's kind of running like a little rogue, go and find space. You know, it was Will Corrigan, coach's son, high IQ player. Will, you were the coach's son, don't forget it. And he would just always find, you know, decent space, or Sergio would have a step down, or I was comfortable shooting it from 15 hands free. Like, it really, I can't stress enough how many red flags are up for me that I'm actually going to go and rewatch the Duke possessions and go, where is the talent gap that players either aren't comfortable enough, which could be, you know, a product of Duke season not going as well as they can. And, you know, sometimes coaches, they really just put the pressure down so much that players start to worry about the coach's reaction as they get a shot off or as they get ready to throw a pass. I know certainly in my first 2 years, when I see a skip pass and I know Corrigan had, you know, we've had a bad practice, I'm hesitant to throw that skip pass because what if it gets tipped? So I'm curious. There's so many factors and so many questions, but all that's to say, it's a comfort level, it's a talent level, it's a comfortability, it's a meshing, it's a locker room. Like, you know, I even think back to their game against Jacksonville in which Aiden McGuire made an unbelievable play and their bench was silent. Like, I have some serious concerns about Duke, not just for this week, but like the core of this group. And it's the first time I can say that in my lifetime.
I just would echo a lot of Larkin's points. You know, I think it's evidenced in the personnel changes that they've made offensively in terms of, you know, we had an article on Inside Across this week about how Max Sloat looked to be the answer at that third attack spot and how in the wake of having Brennan O'Neill, that was a huge question with the left side. And that's not just at the attack. It's also with the first midfield line. I think that they feel confident that you have Eric Molliver is the quarterback. And then on the first line, you have Andrew McAdory and Ben Johnston. But beyond that, there are a lot of questions. And, you know, as Chris Kusa alluded last week, and I think that to the point about zone, for me, if I were going to utilize a zone, it would mostly be to try to get more predictable shots for my goaltender. And I would want that for one of two reasons. My goalie is playing poorly and more predictability in where the shots are coming from feels like it could be a solution, or my goalie is playing exceptionally well and I think he can save us out of this game. I mean, I don't know that there has been a team that has been more back and forth with their goalie position than Denver so far this year. And, you know, I don't know what it means, but it probably means more than nothing that, you know, Noah Manning's younger brother Grayson has been the goalie that's been going back and forth with Malcolm Kleben, and Kleben comes in and makes 11 saves and Noah Manning goes for 6-2. I just want to reiterate, I don't know what that means. It might mean literally nothing. But with that being said, it's funny that Duke had such a long streak of wins against Denver, because I remember, I believe it was 2010, might have been 2012, we hosted a Mile High Classic at the Broncos Stadium, and it was the last week of the regular season. It was 2012, because I didn't go to the epic Hopkins Loyola game because I was in Denver. And Dino started five seniors that hadn't started all year, and they were down 5-0 10 minutes into the game. And Denver was not going to make the NCAA tournament had it not been for that win. That was the year that they had the epic trio of games against Loyola and ended up losing the ECAC final and then played him again in the quarterfinals. And I remember there was a lot of controversy around that decision, which reminds me, I didn't mention the controversy in the Army Boston U game. That game went to overtime because Army scored a goal with like 36 seconds left when there was very clearly two players that had stepped in the crease during a ground ball scrum on. So if you're an angry BU young alum, please don't tweet at me. Make it to this part of the podcast and you'll recognize that I
tweet it at me. I want the smoke.
Yeah. Nick wants all the smoke. So anyway, I couldn't believe that Duke had such one-sided success against Denver, because it felt like this had been a part of their series history dating back 15 years. I thought Duke lost the game when they went with game jerseys and practice shorts. So for whatever that's worth.
Going back to the Ivy League, Princeton 13, Harvard 11. I think this was a fascinating game for a number of different reasons. To briefly take a step back, after a loss to Cornell last week, Princeton's now 5-2 with the number one RPI and hardest schedule in the country. So it's a good time to be a Princeton lacrosse fan. And for the firepower of both of these offenses, dare I say it was a little bit lower of a scoring game than I expected. I was kind of hoping, if not expecting, you know, a 17-15, roughly in that ballpark result. And I feel like there were kind of like three pillars that were really interesting to track: good offenses versus horrific faceoff units. Both of these teams are at the bottom of the barrel faceoff wise. Manufacturing turnovers in transition and kind of trying to win because both of these teams don't really rely on faceoffs. They both can kind of be comfortable trying to press in the ride, trying to, you know, muck it up. And then the final one was limiting superstars. Each had their moments, but Princeton ultimately executed better. A quick snapshot of how those three turned out. Princeton won 11 of 14 first half faceoffs. They ended the first half up 8-4. After that, they went 6 of 13 to end up 17 of 27. But that first half, Princeton dominated the stripe. As far as limiting firepower, Sam King is the motor of Harvard's offense. For Princeton, it's Mackesy. Sam King finished 1-1. Mackesy finished 2-2. Shout out Colin Molshine and the rest of Princeton's defense for limiting Sam King's productivity. We can dive into additional scoring here in a second. And then the final one, Harvard hounded Princeton on the ride and off of faceoff wins. But Coach Burns summed it up best. He said they were better in choosing the shots to take. So chaos, Harvard wanted to play a chaotic game. They wanted to play with fire, but sometimes that fire can burn you where you have a big turnover and then you have a D-middy come up and just not make the right or the consistent decision to get a good shot. And ultimately, I think that pillar of Harvard manufacturing chaos but not coming away with continually exceptional decision making, which you would need to beat Princeton, was ultimately the nail in the coffin. But a good game, two good teams. Princeton 13, Harvard 11. Terry, looks like you had a couple things that you wanted to say.
Well, you dropped a nice pun and didn't even realize it with the burn. Sometimes yeah. You play with chaos, it'll burn you. I thought Jerry's comments post game were really illustrative and gracious, but it was the part that you highlighted, which was they rushed their shots. And, you know, it's interesting that you would, I mean, Ryan Kroddick made 17 saves, and I guess I'm now thinking about it in real time. They scored 11 goals, he made 17 saves. Yeah, you're probably looking at it and saying that's the reason he was at 60%. You know, if we had been more patient with our shooting, our placement would have been better, and he would have been closer to 50%, and we would have won the game. So, you know, I don't know that this one requires as much detailed analysis as some of the others, because I think the core conclusion has kind of already been established, which is these are two really good teams. Harvard is in a position where their season is going to be determined by the outcomes of games yet to be played. You know, Princeton has done enough where I don't want to say that they can coast, but, you know, they've banked a lot that they're in a really good spot. Harvard's still got a little bit of work to do. Until Larkin's earlier point, we're going to learn a lot about them on Tuesday.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add is that, so I actually think like where Harvard sits in my own head is perhaps not enough credit given to where they sit in the RPI. Like ultimately, because of the Michigan and Syracuse results, right? Even if, say, Colgate, if that loss becomes worse over time, it's like, well, it's so like as an example, this weekend, it's like a net offset because Syracuse beat Colgate. So it works both directions. And as we all know, losing to Princeton with where Princeton sits, not only does it not hurt you in the RPI, it like helps you because your strength of schedule gets better. So Harvard's in a great spot. I mean, this game played out more or less exactly how I thought it would. And I think that there are still major question marks with respect to like Harvard to win enough faceoffs at the Ivy League tournament to win two games against a Princeton and a Cornell, or to beat, you know, a Maryland in the first round or whoever it may be. Pick your favorite matchup, but Harvard is better than they have been over the last few years, and I think Princeton is as advertised. So I think Princeton is squarely in that kind of like Final Four contender, but not yet kind of AAA is the term I like to use in terms of like that elite and safe tier. But I thought it was a great contest. You know, I spoke with Will Walker briefly, and he was there in person and felt really strongly that, you know, they just like missed a few plays with respect to shooting efficiency, but ultimately like the product was fairly even. And I trust his opinion with respect to eye tests. So, you know, I think it'd be great for Harvard if they hold serve against BU and Binghamton, and then their Ivy slate sets up very well in terms of pacing, because it's like do your job against Dartmouth, right? And you'll be 2-1. And then you have three chances to win one game and secure your spot. So, you know, I don't know where they're going to be with respect to, like, do they have to win the Ivy semi if they make it, right? But I think, you know, alums should be happy and two good teams. Great day for lacrosse.
All right. So we are approaching the time limit here that we set for ourselves because we respect you, the listener's time. We still have a ton to cover, so we'll just do like kind of quick hitter segments. I'll say a game, one sentence each, and then we'll fly through it, and then we'll probably end up expanding on a bunch of stuff anyways.
We got to get Larkin to his sangria. is what it really is.
Listen, Larkin is taking time out of his schedule to join us. Terry, as you said, I wouldn't do the same, but I've proven that I would do the same. I'm going to remember that. Quick hitter segment. Fairfield, last undefeated team after beating Drexel, 12-11. Terry, talk to me about Fairfield.
Congrats, Andrew Baxter. Obviously, what they've built culturally is really impressive and resilient. And now that they start on their CAA path, this is a nice win to get under his belt.
Larkin, anything on Fairfield?
Nervous about Fairfield. Like, I think that if you strip away all the positive, just like narrative momentum, like, I don't love their schedule for sustained success in May because of the exact argument I just made about Army. Like they should be able to pound Drexel, right? And I think an official prediction is I think Fairfield on upset watch as the one seed in that conference tournament and a potential like surprise entrant. But irrelevant to that fact, like Bax has done a great job and they've obviously had a really good spring. But
and shout out Brent Adams, Fairfield alum, great guy, great teammate. Moving on, Rutgers beats Hopkins. Now, if this weekend plays out different, this is something that we're talking about to kick off the show. Larkin, 11-8. Pardon me?
Yeah. A week after I wrote a hot seat article, this was not a fun one for the Hop faithful. Hopkins is good. I think Terry's been on it all season as we've podcasted together. Like, I think we all universally believe that like Hopkins is well-coached and good. I'm not sure they're elite this year. And because of that, it makes every single one of these Big Ten matchups like really tight and real no like true path to sustained success other than like just out executing and winning 9-8 against the Michigans and the Penn States and the whoever. But the part that was somewhat surprising is like Rutgers has been down. Like Rutgers, I think a lot of people give benefit to the fact that like for the last decade, really starting with Jules Henningberg era, like they've been quite good. Even in years where they missed the tournament, like this year, they're not really that. And they've had some real like eye opening losses. So, you know, bad day to be a J, but, and this is a big, but like they still control their destiny. They have a very challenging schedule down the stretch. And if they can shut me up by just like winning two out of their next three or whatever it may be. So still Terry? A ton to play for in that room. And yeah, go ahead.
Hayden Sommer, 3 goals and an assist, came in with 2-6 on the year. Player that I loved on the recruiting trail, Texas kid, went to Culver. I think he was originally committed to Air Force, then Army, and then ended up pledging to the banks of the Raritan. Is that the river that Rutgers is on? And I think he's what they've needed, what they've been missing offensively. Connor Cadilla is obviously, I mean, I don't know whether or not he's a top 12 midfielder based on Rutgers season so far, but if you're kind of drafting, he probably is talent wise and that needs to be complemented, right? And there's kind of a top down north south component to creating stress on opposing defenses that they hadn't had. And you know, a game like this, right, it's kind of similar to Andrew Pape. You gotta build on it. Doing it once is one thing, shows that you're capable of it. Doing it multiple times shows that you're consistently good. And being consistently good is the difference between being good and not being good. And so now if you're a Rutgers fan, that's what you get to watch for and what you get to build on. For Hopkins, I mean, they lose a game like this. They've lost a game like this each of the last 2 years, so I'm not going to lose my mind about it. This is the equivalent of losing to Navy last year.
Got it. Being good is the difference between being good and being
not good. No, consistently good. Consistency. That was the point I was making.
Yeah, but I wanted to dumb it down and just take a little pot shot. Bucknell over Lehigh. Bucknell now has 2 wins in a row over Colgate and Lehigh for the Buffalo. Shout out Cody Wheeler, Boise kid, committed to Bucknell. Rocky Mountain left the attackman. Excited to see what he does. But Bucknell, 2 wins in a row. Terry.
Livy Dunn. I don't think there's anything else that needs to be said about this one. If you get a video wishing you luck from one of the more famous women in the world, it's gonna manifest on game day.
Yep, Livy Dunn did send a video to the Bucknell men's lacrosse team saying good luck. I can only imagine the.
I should say that I don't know definitively that that was not artificial intelligence, but it probably wasn't.
Oh, let's not take that away from the boys. Oh, no. Let's not take that away from the room. She just likes him. She wants to go out with him.
Yeah. Richmond beats Georgetown. You know, kind of in the, oh, Richmond's here to play. They've been proving it all season. They're not going to do anything stupid and drop a big blowout game versus Georgetown. No, they're not. They're going to win 13-12. So going into it, Richmond was 14, Georgetown 13. Richmond comes away with the one-goal victory. Larkin, the Spiders. Well,
I mean, it's basically exactly what we forecasted. It's two kind of teams in a similar tier. I hope it gives the Richmond room some belief and, like, that they can carry. You know, they've had a great year. I hope they're rewarded by a productive A-10 schedule and a really good championship matchup with either UMass or St. Joe's. And, you know, I think this gives Kevin Warren kind of like a drumbeat as they head into Big East play. That's a very winnable conference, as we all know. There's no reason Georgetown can't still go to the tournament. So excited about that. And back to Bucknell just quickly. I thought there were some really good one-goal games down the slate. Like, I thought, or two-goal games, but high-quality contests with, like, Vermont Bryant, UMBC Albany. So just a great weekend of lacrosse all in. Awesome stuff.
Terry, anything on Richmond?
Nothing on Richmond. The other game that fell into this category in terms of top 20 matchups that we didn't talk about was Syracuse 16, Colgate 12. And my only comment there is, I mean, what is a cooler quirk of statistical history than Joey Spallina assisting Owen Hiltz on what was the 200th point for each of them? That is, like, the odds of that happening are so small. Very, very cool moment from that one.
Yeah, and I do want to give a shout-out to Colgate. They were down 11-4, and then they crawled back and just, you know, it was 14-12 at one point. So even though the ultimate result was a four-goal difference, they scrapped after kind of, you know, tanking in the first quarter, halfway through the second.
And that was a feature of the Richmond-Georgetown game as well. Richmond was up 12-5 at one point before Georgetown scored the last five goals. So, you know, I'm a little ambivalent on how to react to those types of comebacks, especially when they come off short.
Two quick Barking points.
Anything on Colgate?
Nothing Syracuse. On Colgate. I think it's crazy, especially because I'm dating a girl from Cornell, but crazy not to at least reference Curse with 9-1, you know, in New Haven. I think he scored 8 goals in the first quarter. If Yale was having a better...
6 in the first quarter, 8 in the first half.
6 in the first quarter against a coaching staff that, like, the entire week was talking about how they're not going to let him, you know, dictate the tempo of the game, I'm assuming. So, you know, got to give flowers there. Tip the cap. And then second, quick prediction. Just because Virginia's season is over from an RPI perspective, I think Virginia sets up as this really interesting spoiler. I believe they will knock off not just one, but potentially two of the big four matchups they have left. Like, I think Virginia can beat a Syracuse or a Duke and play spoiler down the stretch here. So that is one to keep in the back pocket of, like, how does Terry's job become impossible at Inside the Cross of writing the bubble articles? It's if Virginia starts playing spoiler.
and speaking of Virginia, they played Utah. You know, and I think I was right. You know, Utah upsets UVA, and I am lying. Terry's prediction was right. Mine was wrong. Utah lost 14-9, but I love the Utes, and I just wanted them to sneak one past Virginia. So, Terry, you can brag all you want right now.
Well, I mean, it wasn't a prediction. It was like, I have Patrick McEwen created a program so I can predict what the RPI is going to be based on the results. Like, it's not. But thank you. Their RPI is 24. Which isn't, they're not out of it yet. They're not out of it yet.
One of the all-time jinxes is like everybody hyped up Utah after they beat Ohio State. They haven't won a game since. They got back on the plane. I told them they could drink in Mormon country and nothing good has happened since.
Navy beats Holy Cross. That's not news, but in overtime, that's news. Final score 9-8. Terry, OT winners for Navy over Holy Cross.
Survive in advance.
Larkin?
Survive in advance, but Holy Pillow Fight. Not a great product.
Holy Pillow Fight. Advance and survive, some would say. And then final game that we will just give kind of a shout out to. Lafayette takes Loyola down for the first time in program history, 11-10. Loyola 0-8 with four losses by one goal to Maryland, Hopkins, Providence, and Lafayette. I don't know what to make of Loyola, but shout out to Lafayette. First program win over Loyola. Credit.
Yeah, I'm curious. Riley Sullivan, leading scorer in the country. well, was coming into this weekend. CJ went for 10. That probably changed things up a little bit. But All-American? I don't know. It's worth a second look.
Happy for Lafayette and those guys. Seems like a good group of dudes. One thing just for lacrosse fans to monitor, it's like very rare that you get to see a national championship quality program and coach, like someone who's truly been to the top of the mountain, like actually rethink how they do everything. And that is what we could have with Loyola, you know, starting in May with respect to Toomey sitting down and like, you know, do we make adjustments in the staff, either in terms of like actual humans or, you know, obviously there's really good coaches and legends on that staff, so nothing against them, but, or do they flip sides of the ball? Do they potentially change their recruiting strategy? Do they look at the transfer portal more versus what they've been doing? Like, you know, it's just very rare that you get a Toomey type at 0-8 and like a real kind of reshuffling of their internal algorithm. So just something to monitor.
And then final talking point as we wrap up here, Larkin, give us what the next couple hours for you look like. Just rub it in. How much fun is it going to be? Just hit us.
Yeah, I got a buddy downstairs at the bar who's very confused why we trained all the way up here for me to podcast. But the beauty in this region is that they eat very late, even though it's a Sunday. So we're going to go to a series of 5 to 7 restaurants here and kind of have little bites and different types of both of traditional alcohol and wine at each spot. And it should be delightful. But it's a cool story. It's a walk-on at Brown. Did extremely well working as an engineer at Palantir. And now he works as a chef in Paris for fun. So when people think about like actually chasing
why is
your
he
passion,
not on the podcast?
He's the man, by the way. Yeah. But just, you know, you don't have to go be a banker and like a little arrow. You can, if you want to chase your passions and do things beyond the scope of, you know, selling insurance or whatever it may be, you can go chase that. So it's fun to be here and it's a really cool place. My dad studied abroad here and played semi-professional basketball. So it's fun to be in the region. And
that's so sick.
All good.
That's cool.
That'll do it. NCAA.com/LaxTickets, $5 off. Larkin, go have a great time. Nick, you're the man.
Love you guys.
Love you more.